This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Take a look around you. Chances are pretty good you will see things that have been inspired by cultures other than your own. When we like something, we snap it up. Susan Scafidi is our guest this afternoon, and she calls us cultural copycats. Susan Scafidi is a professor of law and history at Southern Methodist University and the author of Who Owns Culture? Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law. She also has a blog on intellectual property protection and the clothing and textile industry called Counterfeit Chic. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan Scafidi is currently a visiting professor at Fordham Law School. She has also taught at the University of Chicago Law School, St. Louis University School of Law, the Yale Law School, and the Georgetown University Law School. The book, Who Owns Culture, is published by Rutgers University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Scafidi, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, Susan, please, and thank you so much for having me. And let me add that I call us cultural copycats only with the greatest of affection.
It's something we all do, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's wonderful. Part of being a heterogeneous culture is borrowing from others. In fact, I think sometimes we're able to accept the cultural products of others, cuisines, music, and so forth, before we're very comfortable with our new neighbors.
Right.
So it actually is a very positive thing.
So it plays a role in assimilation and integration.
Well, integration, surely. Perhaps not assimilation, because we value those differences so much. It can be sometimes, of course, difficult for new cultures to see their objects appropriated in sort of a colonialist fashion. But I think overall, for most things that are appropriated, it is very positive indeed.
Yeah. There's a lot of swapping, though, going back and forth.
There is, and we get marvelous mixes. That's why we have Tex-Mex cuisine, for example.
Right. Is the eagerness to adopt and adapt, as in Tex-Mex, something we find universally attractive across the world? Is this something people do?
I think it is. I think different cultures have a greater rhetoric of purity or authenticity than others. As Americans, we have a great rhetoric of borrowing and of appropriation and of mixing. But I think that it's truly a universal phenomenon. Humans are very creative, and we borrow from all kinds of sources.
Yeah. Would you like to say something about the process by which things move from one group to the wider world?
Yes, I think that as a group becomes more visible, becomes seen, then one of the ways that it identifies itself is through not its individuals, but its cultural attributes, the way it dresses, dances, plays music, cooks, all of these things. And with that visibility becomes a desire to be copied, and for outsiders, a desire to copy. And I think that it's part of what makes us comfortable with one another, those kinds of exchanges as they go on. Sometimes it's because you have someone new in the neighborhood. Sometimes it's because people travel to other parts of the world. Sometimes it's because people just go down the block to a new ethnic neighborhood that's forming. So it happens in all kinds of ways. And, of course, the Internet facilitates that tremendously at this point.
Yeah. Imitation is flattery. And we're flattering not only those who we are, I don't know if copying is the right word, but imitating. And at the same time, we're also looking to gain a little luster for ourselves, right?
Absolutely. You know, Pierre Bourdieu, the late French sociologist, I should say, refers to this as cultural capital. We're no longer colonialists, thank heaven, going around the world and collecting other countries, or certainly not other people, but we do go around and collect the things that we use to make ourselves more cosmopolitan. So yes, we are definitely adding luster to ourselves in some ways, because it's a mark of sophistication to be familiar with many cultures and to be comfortable with their cultural attributes. So yes, I would agree with you there.
Yeah. Well, you begin the first chapter of your book with some words from Proust. She was surrounded by her garments as by the delicate and spiritualized machinery of a whole civilization.
Indeed. Those words really inspired me because clothing is, of course, one of the things that is most indicative of a culture, but it is also a close form of personal expression. And I think that quote from Proust captures those two things so beautifully, the collective and the individual. And, of course, the inspiration for writing the book had a lot to do with studying areas of intellectual property that are less protected than others, and particularly group creativity. And so I think when you talk about something that exemplifies a whole civilization, group creativity takes a huge role in that. In fact, I called cultural products at some point, I believe, accidental property, because the things that we do in our daily lives when we cook or get dressed are very creative and part of our culture. But it's a kind of creativity that we don't think about, and we certainly don't think to run to the copyright office first thing when we do.
Yeah. That term, cultural products, that's the term that you use in your scholarship, in your work in this field. Maybe you'd give us some further examples of what are cultural products. We talked a little bit about what we wear and what we eat, but there's so much more.
Oh, of course. Things like traditional medicine, the music we listen to, elements of our religious rituals, of our dances, of the fiction we write, particularly when it's something like fan fiction, that we're borrowing folklore, telling stories to one another, whether it's 1,000 years ago around a campfire or over the internet today. All of these are cultural products. They're cultural attributes that are part of an ongoing process of creativity.
Mm. Yesterday, the National Geographic Holiday Catalog came in the mail at our house. And from this catalog, you can order items made by craftspeople around the world. Meanwhile, you can find similar items in a discount store or on a stall on a street corner. Now, many of us will opt for the discount option or that person selling these things on the street corner without thinking too much, if at all, about where this thing we are buying came from, who made it, and who will profit from its sale. Should we be thinking more carefully about those questions?
Celeste, in some ways, this is the dark side, or at least the ambiguous side, mm-hmm. of cultural collecting, or if you will, cultural appropriation. The ideal, of course, in my view, is that we do think about where these things come from and the people who created them. And hopefully, those people get some kind of remuneration for their creativity, in so much as it participates and partakes of their own cultures that they're sharing with us. In other words, we should value authenticity in some ways. Does that mean I think that the discounts and the copies shouldn't exist? No, they also serve a role in disseminating different kinds of aesthetics and disseminating different information. But it's best, I think, when we at least, if we do prefer the copies over the originals, to at least be mindful of where they came from, to attribute them, at least mentally or intellectually, to their source cultures.
Hmm. Are our feelings about fakes somewhat ambivalent?
Our feelings about fakes are very ambivalent. Yeah. I think everybody loves a bargain, and everyone loves doing something clever, yes, and getting away with a copy. But at the same time, I think we also honor creativity in a way that perhaps we never have before, whether that's creativity in terms of clothing or writing or anything else.
Hmm. Well, who was it that said, yes, it's my hair, I bought it? You know?
I don't know, but that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes, and certainly cultural standards of beauty are another export, so we have that as well.
Yeah. Well, designers are great borrowers. You know, and you know, here is something that you talk about on your blog. You know, is it inspiration or is it theft or, you know, what is it?
Designers are tremendous borrowers. And one of the cultural issues is that designers send staff members around the world to photograph inspiration and to bring back wonderful textures and colors and lines for clothing. And very often the original sources are a bit obscured in the result. On the other hand, along with these kinds of collective creativities that are freely, and I think in many cases well borrowed, but it's a good idea, we also have true original talent and original creativity. And sometimes when those things belonging to individuals, not attributable to a whole culture, are borrowed, copied, stolen, it actually harms creativity because it prevents the individual designer from being able to recoup the results of his or her individual investment. So I think it goes both ways. You know, creativity is positive and copying is positive on the one hand. It can be harmful on the other. It's a matter of finding the balance.
Yeah. How does the fashion industry deal with this? How do they go about people in the industry deal with, you know, finding that right balance?
The fashion industry runs as fast as it can to stay ahead of copyists.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that, even though I am a law professor sitting in my office, is that historically the United States has not granted the same kinds of protection to fashion design that it has to other areas. Now, this is not because fashion copies more than anything else. Certainly the movies copy, literature copies, music copies. In fact, music very controversially copies, and we may want to come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But in large part because the copyists have been able to defeat any kind of legislation that would bring fashion design into the realm of copyright. So fashion designers have sped up their seasons. They have attempted to use trademarks as a way to defeat copyists and slap trademarks on the outsides of their designs so that they can't be copied, at least not legally, and have rested on social norms that say, you know, the original is somehow better than a copy in social terms.
What are the pros and the cons of protecting an industry like the fashion industry?
I think protection of any industry does two things. It incentivizes people to engage in additional creation by giving them financial rewards going forward, and it also incentivizes them to create by recognizing their past contributions, right? By making those things attributable to them, by honoring their work. And so the pros are of protection are allowing that kind of creativity, supporting that kind of creativity through protection. The cons, well, if you give anything too much protection, it makes it very hard to borrow from it in the future to create new works, to use it as a source of raw material for new ideas. And so again, the important thing is to find a balance.
Mm. And this is a part of the discussion that's going on in the online world as well, is what should we protect and are we overprotecting material?
Very much so. There's been such a revolution in creativity in the internet era. Because it's so easy for us to come together as groups the way we once might have told stories around a campfire, now we do it online at all hours of the day. And because so much of our creativity has been corporate over the past century, many of our cultural references are trademarked or are copyrighted. So when we come together to engage in new informal types of creation, like on the internet, sometimes we run into legal problems.
Hmm. Let's at this point take a call from a listener. Let me reintroduce our guest. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Scafidi. She's a professor of law and history at Southern Methodist University, currently a visiting professor at Fordham Law School. She's also the author of Who Owns Culture? Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our first listener to call in this afternoon is calling us from Champaign. He or she is on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is, I believe in everything the writer, your guest, has said, but I just received a phone call from somebody who had really big style, but she has absolutely advanced disease. What do you say to people who are ill? I am ill also, but she is much more ill than I am. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I'm not sure what the question is there, but...
I'm so sorry to hear about your illness.
Yeah.
If we're asking about things like traditional medicine and the use of intellectual property to protect both traditional medicine and modern medicine, that is a very difficult problem. That is to say, when we have traditional kinds of creativity, it receives no protection, but it also receives no money, no research money to prove its efficacy. So when we're talking about, for example, Chinese traditional medicine, herbs, that sort of thing, very little Western research money has been devoted to that because it has no intellectual property protection. On the other hand, modern medicine has very high levels of intellectual property protection, which can make ensures that research money is dedicated to it, but it also makes it difficult for patients to access it. So again, it's a very, very difficult area of the law. And a very difficult place to find a balance because there are such important humanitarian concerns. So, I hope that addresses the question.
Yeah, yeah. In regard to products that are created by a group or that have been handed down that are traditional, if we could use that word, why are we reluctant or uneasy about protecting that, about funding that, about giving that authorship to that group or that subculture?
Celeste, I'm so glad you put a verbal question mark after the word traditional, because I think that's part of the problem. One of the issues is that it's very hard to figure out what is part of a particular culture and what is not, particularly since culture is fluid, culture evolves. Mm-hmm. And so we certainly don't want to freeze or reify a culture in a particular point in development and say, aha, at this point we know what your cultural products are. We know what is authentic and what is not. Everything else is part of the public domain, but you must keep cooking in this way, dressing in this way, building this kind of building, because that's what your culture does. And so I think one of our concerns about protection is that reification of culture. Another is just that we would cut off the benefits of exchange and that kind of sort of cultural ambassadorship that I referred to earlier.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, I had heard recently that there was a movement by chefs to copyright recipes. I don't know exactly how that would work. Are you familiar with this, or how would that affect?
I am. This is a wonderful question. To my knowledge, there is not so much a movement by chefs to copyright recipes, but there has been a lot of exploration of the social norms among very top-level chefs. The norms against copying one another too exactly. There was a little scandal earlier this year when an Australian chef was found to have been copying multi-star U.S. and European restaurants' signature dishes very exactly, right down to the same ingredients, the same plating, everything. And it was kind of shocking, and he risked and, in fact, harmed his own reputation by copying other people's signatures. So in general, food is not protected by the intellectual property system. Recipes, as they are written out, have a very thin protection just based on the actual choice of wording used. But in general, food has never been copyrighted, and I don't think it's likely to happen soon. But it is interesting to note this kind of movement to make certain dishes at least socially proprietary.
Thank you.
Good
you.
Question. Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Oh, hi. I was hoping you could address the issue of kind of the extension of copyright that just keeps going on, especially when it comes to movies and such. And I'm specifically thinking of things like the Disney properties, where they've been pushing to keep extending copyright protection, even though, you know, some of that stuff should have gone into public domain already. And the irony, of course, being with Disney, that they've made so much money off of public domain materials, yet, you know, are not willing to let any of their own stuff fall into the public domain. And I guess the corollary to that, of course, is the fact that trademarks, you get something like Mickey Mouse in there, is also a trademark as in addition to a copyright. And I wondered if you could talk about that and just, you know, is this ever going to stop? Are they ever going to stop extending those copyrights? And I'll hang up.
That's a wonderful question. The term of copyright is indeed very long. It's currently in the United States, the life of the author plus an additional 70 years. What's interesting, and of course, with apologies to the De Beers Company, a trademark is forever, so long as you continue to renew it. The issue is that in the world of intellectual property, there are haves, and the haves are very wealthy, and there are have-nots. Those things that are at the core of intellectual property protection, you're right, Disney and its characters and its movies, written work, musical works, and so forth, get a very high level of protection, and arguably too high a level of protection, that does continue to be extended, and it would something that is very controversial. Then there are other things that receive no protection at all. Fashion designs are one of them. Some of the cultural products that I've talked about are another group of things. And so what's interesting to me in juxtaposing these is the way that the intellectual property system defines human creativity. We define it as individual, as high status, things that are more historically male than female tend to have greater protection, therefore writing over, say, quilting, for example, mm-hmm. And these kinds of cultural values are very much embedded in our system from the Enlightenment era to the present day. Even as some of our own social values have changed, the legal system incorporates the old ones.
Mm. When did protection of intellectual property become part of our property law?
It became part of our property law before there was even U.S. law, really. It comes from the late medieval or early modern period, patents starting in about the 14th century, copyright a little bit thereafter. Before the United States was formed, 12 of the 13 colonies already had their own copyright statutes. And our first Copyright Act was in 1790. Now, it was a much shorter period of time, just 14 years, as opposed to the life of the author plus 70. But we've had it around for a long time.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Susan Scafidi, author of Who Owns Culture, Appropriation, and Authenticity in American Law. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. In reference to something you said earlier with traditional medicine, I kind of have to disagree because I've heard about pharmaceutical companies going into the rainforest and other places and examining what sort of, you know, traditional healing methods that they've used, what plants and animals they've relied on, that sort of thing, and then going and tinkering with that and patenting it and, you know, essentially in some respects, you know, ripping these indigenous people off of their traditional healing practices and methods. And, you know, it's like taking and saying, well, because, you know, we've studied it scientifically, it belongs to us now, not them.
Sure. The practice you're referring to is often called bioprospecting or sometimes biopiracy. And you're absolutely right. Because those kinds of traditional medicines are not protected, or at least not from the perspective of the cultures that have developed them, used them over the years, understood their properties as a local matter, large companies can come in and simply take them, isolate the active elements, refine them, and then patent them. And that is an issue that has been raised in terms of fairness and distribution of economic benefits between local cultures that have nurtured and nourished and indeed in many cases discovered these kinds of bioactive elements and the large companies that can then come in and take them. Now, what many large companies are doing actually is now negotiating agreements, and I say negotiating in quotes because obviously there's more negotiating power on one side than the other, but are negotiating agreements with local cultures when they go in to do this. And certainly things like organizations like the American Cancer Society encourage that kind of cooperation with local cultures rather than just going in and taking, engaging in, again, something of a form of colonialism in that regard. So, yes, I think that actually bioprospecting is a good illustration of the haves and the have-nots in the intellectual property world.
You want to follow up, the listener? I think the listener has hung up. Talk with us now. I think here we could get into an interesting area to talk about, and that is cultural reappropriation. I'm thinking of, you write about The Wind Long Gone.
Yes, The Wind Done Gone, Alice.
Oh, yes, book. Sorry. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Talk with us about that, how a group or someone can say, wait a minute, I'm pulling us back to where we should be, and I am taking, and my vehicle is this.
Good. That kind of wonderful reverse appropriation of intellectual properties, pulling them back into the culture at large, is a fascinating issue. Margaret Mitchell couldn't have written Gone with the Wind if we didn't have a concept of the antebellum South that she could draw on. It's part of our own cultural heritage. Having written it, she created a copyrightable and indeed copyrighted book that became very famous and has now been reincorporated as part of our culture. One of the ways that we in the 21st century understand the antebellum South is through Margaret Mitchell and through, of course, the movie that was made of Gone with the Wind. It's our mental image of the South. Alice Randall decided to, as an African-American woman, rewrite that history in a way. But she didn't want to go just back to a general cultural conception of the American South, but to this very vivid image of it that Margaret Mitchell had created, Gone with the Wind. So she essentially reappropriated Gone with the Wind to create her own version of what really happened to Scarlett O'Hara and her own fictionalized half-sister, African-American half-sister of Scarlett O'Hara. The Mitchell estate objected and said that this was an infringement on the copyright in Gone with the Wind, and Alice Randall and her publisher were successfully able to argue that this was, in fact, a parody of Gone with the Wind, a criticism of the original text, and continue publishing the book. But it's a little awkward to have to put that kind of cultural interaction in copyright terms. Even though Alice Randall won, it was a difficult fight. And how nice would it be for us to be able to just simply acknowledge more directly that things that are very successful, a novel that is hugely successful and is made mm-hmm. into an Academy Award-winning movie, is part of our culture, and that we have certain rights to reuse that.
Yeah, it's fair game. Fair
yes.
use is the...
Fair use. And the problem with fair use is you're not allowed to take too much. And the argument was that Alice Randall took too much. But Gone with the Wind is important to all of us, not just because of Margaret Mitchell's talent or genius, but because of the way all of us have incorporated it into our collective cultural imagination. Mm. And that's what the law can't quite get its head around.
Yeah. The music industry. They have been, this industry has been very vigilant about protecting its property. Has it gone too far?
Well, arguably, in some cases, it may have gone too far. When we hear about the computers of 12 or 13-year-olds seized because they've done too much downloading, that's fairly draconian. It's an interesting issue from, again, a cultural perspective, because there's lots of arguments that cultural appropriation has been rampant over the history of American music. particularly African-American musicians from jazz all the way to rap and hip-hop, have argued that the majority culture has appropriated their musical styles and sometimes even specific compositions without attribution and without economic remuneration. So the fact that the music industry has tremendous power and has exercised it in very interesting ways and very aggressive ways is again an example of the disparities within the intellectual property system. Now, I should say that there's one interesting thing about music copyrights, and that is that they are subject to compulsory licenses. In other words, Celeste, if you write a song and I sing it, I can do that, and you can't stop me, but I do have to pay you a royalty. So at some level, we recognize that there's something special about music. And that's a system that I would like to see expanded to other areas of intellectual property so that we could engage in these kinds of borrowings, but with some kind of a hat tip to the original creators.
Yeah, well, if you want to expand protections, as you've been saying, you don't want to go too far because then you run the risk of, you know, setting something in stone and then it's dead. So what would you advocate in the way of expansion? And, you know, can you give us some examples? Does the fashion industry, for example, could it benefit by some further legal protection? Although they've been going after counterfeiters pretty
well, that's the interesting thing.
Intensely.
In the fashion industry, yeah. I have argued, and I have argued before Congress, that there is a certain area of fashion protection that actually needs to be brought into the system, right, that is outside the intellectual property system at present, and that those designers could maybe use a little hand, and that is fashion designs themselves, not the trademarks affixed to them, which do receive a tremendous amount of protection, but the underlying designs. And the reason that I would argue that here's a place where we are out of balance is that traditionally these designs have not been protected, and knockoff artists have been able to make a lot of money knocking off the work of particularly young and lesser-known designers. So you get very, very large corporations knocking off independent indie designers who can't really protect themselves. And as one of those indie designers, Gabby Asfor of the design group Asfor said to me, you know what, the big guys can sell their trademarks. We actually have to sell our designs. So there's a disparity between the huge protection granted to a Louis Vuitton trademark or a Chanel trademark and the no-name designer or lesser-known designer who doesn't get any protection at all because his or her trademark isn't recognizable. So because of the new speed of knockoffs, things go down the runway and knockoffs are available for sale, wholesale at least, within hours or by the next day. The fact that the internet has made copying clothing that much easier, right? Just as it's easy to copy a song digitally, it's easy to copy a photograph of a new design, mm-hmm. send it around the world to be copyrighted very quickly. So these kinds of changes in the modern world tell me that we need to engage in a rebalancing and give some kind of short-term protection. Congress is currently considering just 3 years as a unique protection for fashion designs, and I think that's a great balance, right? Would that all copyright had 3 years or so of protection or some very short term of protection such that we could rebalance that system and encourage secondary works, encourage works that are inspired by currently copyrighted material.
What are the prospects of that legislation for passage?
Of course, we're going into an election right now, so everything is simply tabled and set aside. Mm-hmm. It will be, I understand, reintroduced in the new Congress after the elections, and I think it has a pretty good shot, actually.
Very interesting. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is Susan Scafidi. She is the author of Who Owns Culture, Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law. She is a professor of law and history at Southern Methodist University, and she is currently a visiting professor at Fordham Law School. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. Your questions are invited. 333-9455-800 1-800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes, I find this very interesting because in this community and at this university, we have an issue similar to the kind of things you're talking about in the form of the athletic team's mascot, which is Chief Illiniwek, mm-hmm. who dresses up like a native person and dances around. And actually, I understand, sometimes goes to schools to talk about native people, and yet he has no connection, and the university has no connection to native people.
The issue, I'm sorry, have you finished?
Yeah, well, for the time being, yeah.
Of course, please stay on. The issue of the appropriation of Native American cultural property is a very sensitive one, given the history of so many other things that have been taken away from Native American peoples, land, lives, children. This last taking away or appropriation of cultural property hits a very sore spot, whether it is copying Native American jewelry designs or team mascots that may or may not reflect the kinds of values that the Native American people the mascot is imitating would like to see disseminated. So it's a really difficult problem because the conflicted history of majority culture in the United States versus Native American culture has left very little room for Native American peoples to be amused or flattered by a mascot like that one, or by team names like the Redskins, for example. I am a native, actually, of Washington, D.C., and the Redskins actually lost their trademark, at least temporarily. The Trademark Trial and Appeal Board ruled that the Redskins was so offensive to Native American peoples that they refused to continue its registration as a trademark. Now, a court actually reversed that decision, but it's certainly something that is a touchy area when it comes to cultural appropriation, and one that I think is going to continue to be publicly debated.
Well, I'm one of the few Native American citizens in this community, and when people talk to me about the appropriation of the chief regalia, et cetera, they tell me that I should be honored, and I tell them that, you know, the Europeans came here and they took our country, they took our lives, they took our culture, and I don't think I'm going to let you take my feelings about it, because you can't do that. I still feel terrible that this happened. And the other thing is that the chief designation is a very honored, earned, and almost sacred position in many Indian nations. And to have that kind of symbol dance around for the entertainment of a majority of white people at a sporting event, you know, really flies in the face of the whole idea. So I find it very interesting what you're talking about. And you're talking about fashion and that kind of stuff, and I can understand that. And I'm a writer and artist as well, so I understand copyrights and stuff. But when I think in terms of the severity and the depth and lack of sensitivity that people use to cling to these kind of images is appalling. People are all the time are telling me that, you know, they're doing it in honor to Native people, and yet they aren't. And when NCAA comes in to fill the ethical vacuum and forces them to make some kind of choice, they get all worked up. So just wanted to tell you that and let people know out there in the audience that what you're talking about extends to very serious matters.
I'm so glad you could call and express that. It's one of the things that I tried to do in the book, to create frameworks to have that kind of discussion even within the law, and to create sort of hierarchies of cultural products so we could think about which ones it's okay to copy. You might not object to the copying of fry bread or squash and beans and things like that in Native American cuisine, but you might very much object to the stereotyping of an image.
Let me just say something about fry bread.
Which is certainly not
fry
a tip from Illinois.
Fry bread is not a traditional Native dish.
No, it's not.
Fry bread is a symbol of the destruction of Native people. I admit that fry bread tastes good. So does donuts. But fry bread came in because they no longer were able to hunt and gather. And fry bread is grease-laden, carbohydrate-laden, and as speaking as a native person who's diabetic, that's terrible stuff. And to use that as an off-the-cuff kind of thing, I think is part and parcel of some of the problems that I have with people appropriating stuff. Not only are they appropriating it, but they're reassigning traditions to us, just like they did with the chief. I mean, real chiefs were killed, marginalized, or otherwise incapacitated because they were standing up for the people. So once they were gotten to the position where they couldn't do anything, the dominant society reinvented Indians in the form of stereotypes and the, you know, Wild West shows and the movies. So what Illinois did was take the stereotype that replaced the real thing and institutionalized it. And it's kind of a sappy kind of faux nostalgic thing that they have going. So you have to be careful when you're assigning to other people what their traditions are.
I agree. And that comes in with the authenticity question. At powwows, you very often see fry bread served, and yet there is this issue of it being somehow inauthentic and how to reconstruct what is accurately authentic and what not only is accurately authentic from the past, but what we want to keep for our various cultures in the present.
And I don't have anything against fry bread because it's good stuff, you know, and everything. And it is now a tradition, but it symbolizes the destruction of the natives of this country in a lot of ways. That doesn't make it not taste good. You know, donuts, corn pone, and all of the other kind of poor people's food, you know, that's what people eat, grits. I mean, so I'm just trying to say that.
I don't want to thank the listener for calling, because I think also what he's saying here is that there's a conversation that's going on within a community, and then within that community with the larger group, if I don't know that I've put it very well. But there are a number of conversations underway.
Yeah, I think what you point out is very significant. There are only a half a dozen that I know of that are recognizable Native people in this community. And in the country, at one time, there was less than 1%. So the dominant society is very powerful, and it's the old might makes might, and it's mine, and they don't want to give it up. And because there aren't very many of actual Native people compared to the larger population, it becomes a problem. So I actually... I'm very grateful to some of the activist groups that take up the cause, as long as they don't get too carried away and start to dictate what I feel about it.
Celeste, I agree with you. Part of the and with both of you, with the listener as well. Part of the difficulty in protecting any, or even as we think about protecting or giving some kind of acknowledgement to various cultural products, is the fact that there is a debate within communities as well as between individual communities and the majority culture about what is authentic, what is valuable, what should be protected, and in what form.
Yeah, and that's what this is all about from start to finish here, is really what we've been talking about is exchange all through the hour.
Absolutely. Exchange that is hopefully respectful, educational, and enriching, not exchange that is harmful to the source communities from which things are taken or modified.
Mm-hmm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. I have some other callers we're not going to be able to take this afternoon. I do want to thank the callers who called in this afternoon, and I do also want to thank, of course, our guest. Susan, thank you very much.
Celeste, thank you so much for the invitation. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Susan Scafidi is a professor of law and history at Southern Methodist University, currently a visiting professor at Fordham Law School. She is the author of Who Owns Culture? Appropriation and Authenticity in American Law. The book is published by Rutgers University Press.